You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So welcome back. For those of you who weren't here this morning, I'm David Wessel from the Hutchins Center here, and all the slides and the video, all the slides from this morning are online, and the video, if it isn't, will be on later, but now for something completely different. Miles Kimball is an economist at the University of Michigan who... Fortunately, I sometimes think he must be paid by the word, and he must get double for each word he talks about negative interest rates. So he has some pretty strong views about this, and he'll be followed by my colleague Don Cohn, who's the Robert Kerr Senior Fellow here at Brookings and a former vice chair of the Board of Governors. And then after that, we'll have a panel where we'll try and draw some conclusions from this with Ben Bernanke, also of Brookings, formerly at the Fed, Narayana Kochalakota, formerly of the Minneapolis Fed, now at the University of Rochester, Beth Hammond, whose bio is in here, but whose name is left off the thing, from Goldman Sachs, and Jamie McAndrews from the New York Fed. So, Miles, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, this has been just a fascinating conference, and I think great kudos are due to David and all everyone here who put this together. And there are just so many things we've talked about already that are really important. One, for example, this point about what the markets perceive the effective lower bound to be, having a big effect on policy. The fact that the need to tighten the Basel standards even further means that we better have other things in our arsenal in order to stimulate to get the aggregate demand. And we had some talk about transmission mechanisms that, you know, and on transmission mechanisms, let me just say, every borrower-lender relationship in the economy creates a transmission mechanism. And so there are three times as many transmission mechanisms that are as important as the ones people have talked about today. Those are important, but nobody's talked about car loans. There's just the fact that Treasury bill market, where if the interest rate goes down, it mechanically makes deficit numbers go down so that governments tend to spend more money. So there are just a huge number of things. There's a lot of transmission mechanisms, even if some are occluded or blocked, the negative interest rates will have an effect on the economy. So this is, let me turn to these slides. So this is work with Ruchir Agarwal. So Ruchir, wave your hand. There's Ruchir, who's at the IMF. And this certainly isn't an IMF view, I should say. And I'll give the disclaimer for Ruchir. And this is, you can see the title, Enabling Deeper Negative Rates by Managing the Side Effects of a Zero Paper Currency Interest Rate. This is a sequel to the paper that Ruchir and I have as an IMF working paper, Breaking Through the Zero Lower Bound. And I also have a published paper in the National Institute Economic Review, Negative Interest Rate Policy as Conventional Monetary Policy. And both of these are conveniently available, along with much more, from links on my bibliographic post on my blog. So as David was saying, I've written a lot on my blog about negative interest rates, and I have it all conveniently arranged for you here, but probably the most important are these two academic policy papers. I say academic, but I think they're a lot more readable than many academic papers that are out there. Okay, so this graph is meant to show that historically central banks tend to drop interest rates 600 basis points or so in order to deal with recessions. And so think of the next time around. Suppose that the U.S. might be lucky to get plus 1.5% interest rate before the next recession strikes, even if that's 5 years from now. If you want to drop 600 basis points from that, you're down to minus 4.5%. So you can see that the zero lower bound is really quite a big issue. A lot of countries have fairly low interest rates. Here's the OECD countries. A lot of them are familiar. A few non-OECD countries have fairly low interest rates now, and so might have a zero lower bound problem. And as we've seen, there are quite a few countries. You know, six. It's actually to the countries we've talked about today, Hungary has one overnight deposit rate that's now slightly negative. I know some of the other Eastern European countries are starting to move towards negative interest rates. Okay, so I think it's useful to have a lot of more than one approach to enabling lower rates. A lower bound on interest rates can be a serious obstacle to monetary policy. We do want new tools, but as many of us discussed this morning, the politics matter, the legal issues matter. Monetary politics and law differ from one nation to another, so you need a menu of different tools so that the technical approaches can be adapted to the political and legal situation in different nations. And now, despite the title of this session, this is not I'm not coming at it as primarily being about the U.S. The monetary policy toolkit is really an international one, and what one nation does really does help provide additional thinkable tools for other countries. And so I think that the reason I'm optimistic about an expansion of the monetary policy toolkit is that there are enough different central banks that think about things in different ways and have a willingness to experiment that I think we will see a substantial expansion in the monetary policy toolkit over the next 5 years or so, and hopefully it'll be 5 years before the U.S. needs negative interest rates. Okay, so there are two paths that Ruchir and I want to talk about in terms of a path to deep negative rates. So think of minus 3%, minus 4%. The papers that are written already, I'm going to call the clean approach. An electronic money system that generates a negative rate of return on paper currency, and it's going to get into all the nooks and crannies. It doesn't matter where that paper currency is. Using the central bank's power to determine exchange rates between different forms of money under its jurisdiction. So when I went to the Chicago Fed recently, I asked, hey, where's your cash window? And the economist there I was talking to said, well, we don't know. Well, the cash window is actually a very crucial part of the central bank. You know, that's where the banks that actually interact with the Fed bring their cash, and they say, here, we're going to give you this cash. Please credit it to our reserve account, or they want to withdraw stuff from the reserve account. This is a very powerful, very important part of the monetary system that I think is neglected in money and banking textbooks. This is they ought to have pictures of the cash window in every money and banking textbook and discuss what it does, because that's where the exchange rate between the electronic dollar and the paper dollar is determined. It's been at par for a long time. That's the standard policy. But it's because it's treated at par at the cash window that it's at par. Okay, the dirty approach, which is what this talk is really about, is using a variety of regulations to make it difficult to earn anything close to a zero return on any substantial amount of paper currency while maintaining paper currency officially at par relative to electronic money. And I say officially at par because, of course, as soon as you don't have absolutely free conversion, that, you know, there can be a kind of gray market price that drifts away from par, but you want to at least have it, the official policy of it being at par, stay the same in this approach. And just to remind you, we've had changes in monetary policy, monetary systems before that are of similar magnitude, and the big one is going off the gold standard, but Bretton Woods are going off fixed exchange rate with the Nixon shock was a pretty big deal. Going to negative interest rates. Okay. Oh, sorry.
Webcast can't hear you.
Oh, right. So, we could someday have a cashless economy, but all of the things I'm going to talk about today could be done in very short order. I think getting rid of cash entirely, that might take a decade or two to do right. Okay. So, let's talk about the zero lower bound itself. What does it take to get a safe return that creates an effective lower bound on interest rates? Assuming all government-controlled electronic rates are negative, paper currency really is the issue. Why? First of all, private firms don't have the disregard for profits and the deep pockets needed to pay an above-market rate on an equilibrium rate-altering quantity of funds. So in blue there, you can see the relevant blog post there, how negative interest rates prevail in market equilibrium. you know, you've got trillions and trillions of dollars at negative rates. It's not easy to, you've got to think of trying to run those all through cash. That's a non-trivial task. But the, or cash or whatever it is. But the bigger issue, the bigger point is that assets whose price can vary freely, including notably existing debts whose secondary market price can vary freely, can't create an effective lower bound. You're going to tend to get a capital gain, but in any case, a capital gain, then expected depreciation, and in any case, there's a lot of risk to anything that can change its price. So the thing that's special about paper currency is that it has a government-controlled price of par relative to electronic money. Okay, what if you do think about cash? Again, you still need the quantities it's going to take to create a zero lower bound are going to be a lot. I think it's useful to focus on and how you go from electronic money, that is, you know, money in the regular financials, money in the bank, to money in the bank, which is what's going to be exciting to the folks in the financial markets. To get zero from money in the bank to money in the bank, you've got to withdraw paper currency freely at par, store large quantities of paper currency legally and safely, redeposit paper currency freely at par, and you have to do all of this in decisively equilibrium rate altering quantities. That's trillions of dollars worth of paper currency storage to do that. Okay. Now, just very briefly on the clean mechanism, if you have a time-varying deposit fee at the cash window of the central bank, then that effectively creates an exchange rate when you have it be on net deposits. That time-varying deposit fee is only between the central bank and the private sector bank, so it's very much focused on the price system. No regulations beyond the deposit fee are needed. It has to grow when the target interest rate is negative. It can shrink again when it's positive, so you go back to par at normal if as long as your nominal interest rate is positive. And, you know, if you, this is a chart just showing that there's no arbitrage then, because what you've done is suppose you have negative short rates for a while, minus 2%. Suppose we'd had minus 2% in 2009 and 2010 in the electronic short rates, and then plus 2% from 2012 on, then you can basically get the same effective rate of return on paper currency by having it depreciate. So a paper dollar would be worth one electronic dollar in 2009 in this counterfactual, then 98 cents, then 96 cents in 2011. It would have to stay at 96 cents in 2012, and then it would gradually come back up to par. So I can't dwell on this because I need to go to talk about the dirty approach. So what I want to do now is say, just suppose, as a political constraint, we're not allowed to take paper currency off par. At any rate, we can't do that for a while. Here's a set of policies that will help you go to deeper negative rates without bad side effects. You're going to manage the side effects, and let me talk about each of these in turn. But the main thing I want to emphasize is this is an a la carte menu. You don't have to do them all. Any one of them individually will be helpful. There's a bit of complementarity, but each one will be helpful. And I'd have to say I think the first two are probably the most important. So in discussing these, let me have some background assumptions. You know, unless you have all of the ways that people can lend to the government in unlimited amounts, negative, then other than cash, it's not even worth dealing with the cash problem. So let's assume you have a negative target rate, a negative interest rate on marginal additions in reserves, and you might as well include vault cash, might as well have a negative lending rate. That's not absolutely essential, but I think it's a very good policy, the current ECB policy. It helps support bank profits too, and it certainly helps get lending rates down. And also, interestingly enough, you need to have a negative between year rate and the tax system. That's actually current law. You know, the current law says that the between year interest rate in the tax system is supposed to be set according to other short-term rates like the Treasury bill rate. And so the Treasury Secretary is supposed to set it negative if the Fed goes negative. Okay. And the within year zero rate doesn't matter because there's you can't run through all the trillions of dollars you need to just on that based on that within year zero tax rate. Okay, so the first policy, and again this is an a la carte menu, but this one is actually surprisingly easy. Ban electrification of paper currency. What do I mean by that? In the formal models, the zero lower bound I think of as being enforced in these formal models by people setting up money market mutual funds backed by paper currency. And so there's this clean arbitrage. And the thing is, though, that's not easy to do when the government doesn't want you to do it. You know, even moral suasion saying, look, we frown upon this, don't do it, is going to go a significant distance towards preventing folks from doing this. But I think it's a pretty reasonable thing to do. I mean, it's not like people are doing massive paper currency storage now. Stopping them from doing something unusual that they haven't been doing in the past is not necessarily the hardest kind of regulation to do. Now, interestingly enough, although the clean approach, I think, is I would argue that that's within the legal authority of the Fed, this one is a matter of for the SEC. And so that's one of the interesting features here. So although the Fed might have some authority over if it's inside a bank holding company. Now, a big point I want to make is if you don't let people set up money market mutual funds or some other kind of fund that creates these convenient electronic liabilities that are backed by paper currency, which I think is pretty easy to do, then what is this zero lower bound made of? The big concern after that is really about bank profits. And so that's the thing we want to go to next. So as long as you outlaw the electrification of paper currency or make it difficult in some way, which I think is pretty easy, then we have to worry about bank profits. Now, don't exaggerate how bad that concern is yet, but I think there's a very, very attractive and simple, not simple, but easy policy that is very much along the lines that Jean-Pierre Danthin was suggesting this morning. What you can do is you can use the interest on reserves formula to subsidize zero rates for small household accounts, but it also holds the banks harmless for providing a zero interest rate for the small accounts. If you do that, it has a lot of advantages. It helps keep up the bank profits. It helps you insulate you from some of the political costs of the negative interest rates. And it also means, quite crucially, that the households with small accounts don't have much incentive to withdraw paper currency to store the paper currency themselves. So you can go after the large-scale storage by making illegal the electrification of paper currency, and then you try to avoid the small-scale storage by making it so that a typical household doesn't have much incentive to do that. So again, at the bottom, I've got the name of a blog post here that really addresses this. But I think this is Europe should be doing this right now, is to really attune the interest on reserves formula to explicitly provide these incentives, but also to set a marker saying, look, we'd like you to have a negative rate on the large household accounts, but up to this level, please do a zero. I think it would be easier for the banks to have a negative rate on the large household accounts if the central bank was sort of suggesting, you know, to what what the size of household accounts that should be exempted should be. Okay, and by the way, interest on reserves formula can be quite complicated. So this is not complicating it beyond the kinds of things that have already been done, just tuning it up. Now, a very interesting thing that is actually the current policy in both Switzerland and Japan is to charge banks for excess paper currency withdrawals from the cash window. This is a very interesting policy because basically, because as a central bank, you know when the private banks are taking out paper currency, you can effectively charge negative interest rates to banks. Now, it's a little tricky how the banks pass that on, but I think you can let the private banks figure that out. But the very interesting thing is you can discourage over withdrawal of paper currency simply by assessing the negative interest rates. And then you'd want to let the banks pass that on as they thought thought appropriate. Now, again, this is an a la carte menu. You don't have to do this, but it's helpful if you retire large denomination notes of paper currency. This is very much in the current policy discussion, so this is not beyond what people are talking about. Now, this fifth one is a bigger deal. And again, even if you just do the first four, that's pretty powerful. But I think at some point, you probably want to ban storage of paper currency as a business. Now, here, what you're worried about is the household sort of taking out the maximum amount they're allowed to take out of paper currency every month without incurring the fees for their banks, which the banks would pass on. So you have an exemption amount for withdrawing paper currency. And what you don't want is for somebody to kind of vacuum up all this maximum withdrawal from all the households and then collect it and store it. But I think, again, it's not that easy to do that without being noticed. And if one powerful tool is saying not only can you not be paid for storing someone else's paper currency, but you can't openly pay above par for somebody else's paper currency, that makes it hard to vacuum up the paper currency. And finally, just because it's so close to what happens now and is quite easy, you can put restrictions on flows of cash in and out of the country just so people don't get around these regulations just by trying to do it abroad. I think that's pretty easy. There's a lot of restrictions on cash moving abroad. So in conclusion, the electronic money approach is attractive. I think the dirty approach may also work. In any case, there's quite a large menu of policy options to enable deeper negative rates. And I would hope that there wouldn't be too many people in the room that wouldn't find at least one thing on this menu as an attractive thing to consider. Thank you.
Thanks, Miles. That was really informative and stimulating, and I think you've identified a very important issue here. The currency demand or the availability of currency at a zero interest rate will eventually put, we don't know where, an effective lower bound on the policy interest rates that central banks can impose on the economy, can target in the economy. Arguably, there are maybe some central banks in the world today who would like to keep pushing those negative rates and find out where that limit is and maybe go through. I think there is a lot of appeal to using an interest rate tool, even in highly unusual situations, such as the global economy is finding itself in right now. That's the sort of tool that central banks are used to using. There's a lot of empirical evidence about how declines in interest rates and financial and easing of financial conditions feed through to the economy. It avoids some of the credit allocation and risk issues involved with quantitative easing. And in any event, aggressively using interest rates together with quantitative easing might be a more successful kind of tool. As you saw, Miles has two ways of dealing with this zero interest rate on currency. One, the clean way, which would be just having the central bank have an exchange rate between currency and deposits, and that exchange rate would vary with the negative interest rates, and presumably as the value of currency went down relative to the value of deposits at the Federal Reserve, that would be passed on to its customers. The second way was what he called the dirty way, and that's trying to enforce some of the same kinds of differences, but doing it without this official exchange rate change. So I think the way I've been thinking about this is a little bit a reverse Bernanke. So Ben famously said QE was something that shouldn't work in theory but did work in practice. I see this as something that might work in theory but will never be tried in practice. So a negative Bernanke here. So I think this is a major change and a very big deal. The way Miles portrays this, it's kind of a natural extension of a lot of things that are going on today. And just like getting off the gold standard or the Smithsonian floating exchange rates. It's just another change. But all those other changes were about the relationship of money, defined to be both deposits and currency, to goods and services, and how that might evolve over time. And so far, we've stayed away from or haven't tried having one type of money convert to another type of money by a floating exchange rate. And we've heard already this morning political resistance to negative interest rates. And I would think that there'd be quite a bit of resistance to having one of the things I carry around in my pocket, currency, exchange to a different exchange at varying exchange rates, or have a penalty to something else I carry around in my pocket, which is a checkbook and or a credit card. So the complexity and difficulty of doing this, I think, is nicely illustrated by the components of the dirty approach and how difficult this would be. So in the dirty version, you have to change a lot of laws and regulations to change the relationship of currency and deposits. And you want to allow maybe individuals, as Miles said, to have small amounts of currency, withdraw small amounts of currency without penalty, but you want to have enough penalties and enough walls and enough restrictions that those conversions can't be done in large size. So you need to have those walls be tight enough that the non-households can't overcome the restriction on converting, or the price, the extra price for converting currency to deposits. So it's complex, it's difficult. It strikes me as a little bit like credit controls or capital controls. People will find ways around them. And look at what you have to do there. So, and I know this is a menu, but you've got to be able to do some of these things. Ban electrification of paper currency. So you need the SEC to do something in the U.S. anyhow about money market funds and to restrict money market funds. You can subsidize zero rates for small household accounts, but you better keep track of those household accounts and who's withdrawing what and how that adds up for each bank, so that the banks don't use that to get around the restrictions and the extra cost of converting currency to deposits. Charge banks for excess currency withdrawals. I think that might be possible. I don't know the legal limits on things. People are already questioning whether the Federal Reserve has the legal authority to do negative interest rates, right? So here we're sort of upping the ante and having them charge banks for excess currency withdrawals, retire large denominations. So this would be unprecedented. I can remember when we put new types of $100 bills out there, one of the things we said was, don't worry about your old $100 bills, they'll always be good. The United States has never negated one of the denominations of currencies that it was had issued. So you'll always be able to trade it in. You don't have to worry about invalidating the currency you have. So this would change that. This isn't just don't issue $100 bills. It's to take some of the $100 bills, or all of them that are outstanding, and say they're not valid anymore after a certain point. This is a very big deal and would require at least the Treasury, if not the Congress, to agree to it. Ban storage of paper currency as a business. So, I mean, that presumably would take legislation and take a law. I think all these things aren't as routine as they might seem when Miles is talking about them. They would change the way people did business. There would be pressure on the exemptions. Or would small businesses be exempt as well as small households? People would exercise a lot of ingenuity getting around it. The way they had in the past on deposit insurance, breaking up big deposits and putting them in smaller bundles. Even if there's legal authority to do some of these things in central bank mandates and central bank laws, I think it would, that's almost less important than the discussion that the central banks would have with the public and with the legislatures. No, a central bank would be very short-sighted to implement some legal authorities that it might have to make currency more expensive than deposits without a very extensive conversation with the Congress about why it was doing this, why it was penalizing people who were walking around with currency in their pockets, and what the implications were. And it should do, and it would need to make sure that the public, the legislature, were comfortable with what it was doing. So I'm less worried about the legal authority than I am about the acceptance of this by the public at large. So I don't see this happening. I could say not in my lifetime, but I'm 73, and that doesn't mean so much anymore. But I would say maybe not even in Miles' lifetime, absent a major depression, and having other things tried, and the central bank coming to the Congress and the President of the United States and saying the only way to get out of this depression is to discourage people from holding currency so we can charge them for having deposits, so we can charge businesses and others for having deposits at commercial banks. That's going to be a very difficult conversation, but the only way I can see this happening would be under those circumstances. Everything else had been tried. This was the only thing left, and now maybe it should be given some consideration. So, Miles, thank you for provoking a lot of thought and interest in my mind and thinking about this very important subject some more. I hope that what we do as policy folks is think about ways of avoiding getting into the situation, both with monetary policy, fiscal policy, regulatory policy, et cetera. I wouldn't count on using Miles' machine for getting out of the bad situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. I'm going to give Miles, you get like 3 minutes, and I'm cutting you off after 3 minutes, okay?
Well, so I actually only want to say two things in response to what Don said. I think, first of all, think of the difficulty on the other side. To get a zero interest rate on, you've got trillions and trillions of dollars worth that in the circumstance we're talking about would be at negative rates. Already the world has trillions of dollars worth. If the U.S. were at negative rates, it would be many more. You're talking about trillions of dollars worth of paper currency that you have to store. So getting in the way of that a little bit might be enough. We don't know. But I think you don't want to underestimate the difficulty of the person who wants to get the safe return on the paper currency. I think it's simply unknown how difficult that is if the government's trying to get in the way a little bit. The second thing I want to emphasize is this really is, I really do see this as an international thing. How difficult these things are differs dramatically from country to country. In the U.S., the Fed is under political siege. I mean, Ben, who's a hero, it was called the traitor by a presidential candidate not too many years ago. And, it's tougher in the U.S. than it is in some other places. So I don't expect the U.S. to be the first place to do these things. I think, quite honestly, the U.S. is dependent on the goodness of strangers. Namely, the Fed is dependent on other central banks leading the way for it to ever be able to do these kinds of things.
Yeah, why don't you sit down? So I think we have time for a couple questions. If you guys can just put the mics on, if there are any, a couple questions. Don, I was a little worried when you said not in my lifetime. If 10 years ago I had told you the Fed is going to have a $4 trillion balance sheet, you probably would have said not in my lifetime. So I'm not sure that's a good, I think you might think about that metaphor.
Maybe I should be older before I say that again.
Are there a couple questions? Come on. All right, yes. And there's one in the back.
Hi, this is a question for Don. Just because I wanted to maybe pivot off of something you, what you said about avoiding the need with something Cynthia had done, work that she had presented that showed how frequently you hit the zero lower bound, particularly with the inflation target set at 2%. What do you think, why do, given that, assume Miles has got the right prescription, right, but is impossible, then why not change the inflation targets? And what do you think there would be less political resistance to that? And what then would be the appropriate inflation target to set?
So I'm very hesitant to change the inflation target. I recognize that if you could get inflation to 4% and have that be a credible target, those are big ifs, right? It's hard getting to 2% these days in Japan in particular, but other places too, that presumably nominal interest rates would be higher and you'd have further to go. What I worry about in that discussion, and what I'd like to see more discussion of, is the costs of inflation. So people don't like inflation. And it's not just some of the technical economics, shoe leather, tax system, that kind of thing costs. I think inflation, higher inflation makes it harder to plan. It confuses market signals. It's just probably because people have trouble interpreting market prices as to whether it's real or nominal at these higher rates of inflation, I think there's probably resource misallocation. So I wouldn't rule out going to a higher target, but I don't think the discussion of those targets has fully incorporated all the potential costs. And I think the economists who advocate going from 2 to 4 just to avoid the zero lower bound are, I mean, that's a good reason, but there are other costs involved. So I think we need a fuller discussion.
Can I answer that question too? I think one of the big benefits of developing the monetary policy toolkit so that we can have a robust negative interest rate policy with fairly deep negative rates is that then over time, once we were confident of that new toolkit, we could bring down the inflation target to zero. Now, I say over time, but in Switzerland, where the current inflation is fairly close to zero, simply having people get comfortable with a negative rate policy that could go fairly deep would enable Switzerland to maintain an inflation target at zero. So I think that's a benefit of negative interest rates that's actually important to politically as well as practically.
Cindy, do you want to make the case for raising the... Oh, sorry, Narayana.
Yeah, I have one quick comment on Miles' presentation, which is that I think that actually it's easier to make the case for the clean approach than the dirty approach. I think the clean approach, that's a great starting point, at least for a conversation. The dirty approach makes it seem like you're interfering in every aspect of people's lives, whereas the clean approach, it's just at the cash window, some small thing that's not even pictured in the money and banking textbook. So that would be my piece of advice in terms of selling this agenda.
See, Pierre, Jean-Pierre.
Just wanted to complete that, and because I fully agree. And in fact, it looks like the clean approach makes a lot of sense. The dirty approach, it's like trying to slide through the back door, and I think that's the wrong approach, actually, because it's something that needs to be discussed, and if people agree that this is worth doing, let's do it cleanly.
There's a gentleman way in the back, and then I'm going to segue to the panel, but we're going to...
Hi, this is Miles. I was surprised...
Tell us who you are.
Nathan Tankus. I was surprised that you didn't mention a precedent for the clean approach in American history, which is the American colonial period, where there's a positive interest rate on currency and the tax offices are accepting the currency issued now at a discount now and on face value and at par on face value 3, 4, 5 years down the line. So there's like an extensive history, an antiquarian history, but an extensive history where you're just doing the reverse, where you make it at par now when you issue it and at discounts in the future.
So I think it is time to revisit the history of monetary systems. And so Ken Rogoff has a book called The Curse of Cash that's coming about in January. And so I was a reviewer for that book, and I really liked it, and said, oh, can't you get it to come out sooner? But one of the things he talks about there is a Genghis Khan system for paper currency as a precedent for having a non-par exchange rate. There they had a par exchange rate when you took the paper currency out, but you'd get 50%, or you'd get only half the value if you tried to put the paper currency back in. And that was quite important for making the paper currency such a big thing in
so in just a simple marketing idea here. Calling it the Genghis Khan approach is...
This is not my marketing.
Not a good idea. Just a little tip.
Well, I shouldn't have advertised Ken Rogoff as saying that, but I don't in fact market it that way. But look, I'm very, very... I'm delighted to have people agree with Ruchir and me that the clean approach is much, much better. And so we're, it's an effort to try to understand what resistances people might have to the clean approach to really lay out right. How you could do it piecemeal.
Good. Okay, great. Can I get you to leave your mics and we'll change and the people on the panel come up? So here's how I think we're gonna do this. Before we get negative rates, we're gonna get wireless mics here. I think what we'll do is I'm gonna have a conversation with this distinguished panel up here. I'll introduce in a moment. Then I'm gonna ask any of the other people who've presented if they wanna weigh in on something that, because we've kept people have been very disciplined, and then we're gonna open it up to the audience. Of course, I'm joined here by Ben Bernanke, the former Fed chairman, now at Brookings, Narayana Kocherlakota, the former Minneapolis Fed chairman, Fed president, now at University of Rochester, Beth Hammond, who's the head of short-term trading, is that right? Head of?
Short-term rate strategy.
Short-term rate strategy at Goldman Sachs. And Jamie McAndrews, who's the research director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I think what I'd like to do is to see if we can make some sense of all the stuff we've discussed in the last couple of hours and draw some conclusions. And Beth, I'd like to start with you because I'd like to ask you what effect you think negative rates have had or might have if we tried them in the U.S. on the actual behavior of people in markets and businesses.
So I think there's a couple important things that we teased out this morning that are worth mentioning. I'm not going to try to get into the economics behind whether negative rates do or don't work because I'm massively outclassed on the economic side. I'm just a humble markets person here. But I do think that there is a real impact on the market psychology and on expectations when you look at negative rates. And I think one of the things that's really critical when I think about negative rates is that whether there is or isn't an effective lower bound, markets perceive there to be an effective lower bound. And so once you start moving below zero, markets are taking a signal that you're in a very stressed period and that you're nearing the end of what you can do in monetary policy. And so unlike QE or the LSAT programs where you can continually keep buying, now maybe there are extremes to that, and I think Japan certainly looks like an extreme there. Once you start going negative, you're sending actually a bad signal about the state of the health of the economy and your ability to stimulate it from a fundamental perspective.
And do you think that that's happened already in Europe?
I think it's happened more so in Japan than in Europe, but I think there is a question as to whether or not you're getting real fundamental growth. So I think negative rates seem to me, as a market participant, like they're more effective as a currency control than they are as a stimulative
exchange
tool.
Rate, you mean?
As exchange rate control,
right,
yeah.
Right. And if the Federal Reserve faced a situation where we have a recession and they have to do something and they don't get as much help from the fiscal authorities as they might like, something we'll talk about in a moment, how would you weigh the pros and cons of negative rates versus another $1 trillion of QE?
Well, so let's first stipulate once more two things. One is that the best thing would be to get the fiscal support. We've been relying way too much on monetary innovation, and so I don't want to make the presumption that that's the direction.
Right. Okay,
so that's important. Secondly, for now, we're going to assume Miles's plans aren't in place, and so we're dealing with sort of the current institutional setup. So I don't know. I think, you know, there was a Federal Reserve staff memo in 2010 which looked at this in some detail. And my sense is that, putting aside for the moment psychological issues that Beth just raised, I think it's a kind of a moderate benefit, moderate cost tool that, I mean, in the sense that under current institutional arrangements, probably we could only get, you know, 30 or 40 basis points negative, and then that would involve some manageable but still concerning institutional impacts. So, you know, in a situation, and clearly without fiscal help and in a serious downturn, we don't have a lot of space. So clearly we're looking at everything. So I'm not saying you shouldn't look at it, but it would not be a panacea, obviously. And the advantage of quantitative easing, which has many disadvantages, but one advantage of it is it doesn't have a natural, quite an obvious natural limit. So I've kind of vacillated on sort of what the right sequencing is, and I guess given at this point that QE has been used with some success, I guess that would be my first step.
And how much do you worry about the effect of the banking system of a flatter yield curve?
I think that there's a little bit of a shell game here, which is that talking about the differences, the effects of low interest rates versus negative interest rates. Okay, so given that interest rates are already very low, how much would a few additional basis points into the negative region affect banks, particularly given that you can do the tiering and other things to insulate banks to some extent? Moreover, the profits of banks are not what you're mainly interested in. You're interested in lending, and it's not obvious that on the margin, the lending decision, the banks have to decide whether to lend or to hold reserves. On the margin, it's not clear that some reduction in bank profits, and I think it would be modest, is going to affect willingness to lend. Moreover, I don't want to get in too far into this, but the share of bank funding, which is sort of small retail deposits, is actually not that big, et cetera. So I don't find that to be as big a problem as some of the commentary has it. And in particular, the Fed memo in 2010, the staff memo barely mentioned bank profits as an issue. They were more concerned about money market funds breaking the buck.
Mariana, has what we've seen in Europe and Japan, would that make you more or less willing to try negative rates here if we had to think about that?
So I think there's a couple of ways to answer that question. I think that, first of all, the experiences in a bunch of the European countries really opened my eyes to the idea that negative rates could be an effective tool. The way I think about it is really they're an enhancement to forward guidance. So that forward guidance, if you're at the zero lower bound or 25 basis point lower bound, that tells you something about how low interest rates can be over, say, the next 3 or 4 years if you're in a pronounced crisis, pronounced recession. Whereas if you're able to lower those rates by 50 to 100 basis points, that'll accumulate that over that four-year period. And people are thinking about, should I spend now or 4 years from now? Well, we've got a real kick. So that's in theory, but I think we've seen some of that play out in practice in Europe. I think the Japanese experience really highlighted Beth's point about expectations. That if you sit there as a central banker and you talk about negative rates as being, well, this is something we'd only go to if the world was really collapsing. Well, if you go to it, then you're sending the signal that the world is really collapsing. So I think that and that's a problem that should be solved right now by the Fed talking really openly about, we've got a bunch of tools we might use, and you know, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday by Justin Wolfers about what would central banks and other institutions do if we had a recession. Well, I think the Fed should be talking about that, and I think that it shouldn't be talking about negative rates as being something you would only use in the extremist event, because then, as I say, you're sending that signal that boy, you've reached the end of all the tools, and now we're turning to negative rates.
Well, that's what helicopter money's for. That's the desperate one, right?
That one I actually would leave to Congress myself.
But, Ben, you've made the point that you think there's some benefit to the public thinking that the Fed has some ammunition, because that'll give them the confidence, and we might never have to use it, essentially.
Yeah, no, Nariana's made the point that what matters sort of in the low probability event, even if we never have that, what people think about that possibility actually influences their behavior under more normal circumstances.
Right.
So they have the confidence, for example, that even under extreme circumstances, the Fed, maybe with a little help from the fiscal authority, can address, you know, deflation. That affects their thinking, you know, and affects the setting of interest rates today, for example, long-term bond yields today, for example.
Well, I think that's true. I do think you have to be a little bit concerned about, and I think it's fair to say that you don't want negative rates to be this, you know, really horrific tool that you use only when things are extreme. But by the same token, I think the general populace doesn't really understand negative rates. And I think this concept of negative nominal rates and trying to talk to people about real rates and what that means is very complicated. And so the average American, and frankly, I think even the average corporate executive doesn't necessarily understand that. And so maybe doesn't make the same spending decisions or capital investment decisions in a very low or negative environment.
Right. So Jamie, what do you think would be the problems if we actually tried it here, in addition, besides forget Miles's thing for a minute?
Well, again, my comments don't reflect the views of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or the Federal Reserve System.
And Ariana's and Ben's also do not reflect.
I think Beth's do.
Mine don't reflect Goldman Sachs either. How about that?
I think there's kind of two levels, whether we're, you know, in this mildly negative environment that Ben was talking about, minus 30 basis points, or, you know, beyond 50 basis points and so on. If we get into more severely negative rates, we could expect a lot of institutional innovation. And I think that people would want to pay their bills earlier to creditworthy counterparties and receive their payments later. And this is just a complete reversal of the way trade credit has worked for years and for, you know, time immemorial. And there are many social conventions. One of the things that I think Miles Kimball's, a list of potential policies kind of overlook is that there are a lot of zero interest rate deals out there in society, and people can find them and find ways of exploiting them in time. So I think it does lead to a lot of, fixed costs for society to rearrange practices, long-held practices that are consistent with positive nominal interest rate environment.
So Beth, that kind of goes to, so when the economists talk about negative rates, they act as if, well, there's not much difference between plus 10 basis points and minus 10 basis points, as in there's only 20 basis points different. And we've had negative real rates before, and this is no big deal. But I sense that you're more in the camp that it makes some big difference to the way consumers and businesses think to have a little bit negative is a big deal.
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's also a lot of nonlinearity as you get around that zero lower bound. So if you look at money market funds in the U.S., and maybe it's because we hadn't broken through zero yet, but if you look through, 2010, 11, 12, 13, before you had the reverse repo purchase program put in place at the New York Fed, there was a lot of resistance as you get around that zero lower bound. And what you saw was money market funds in the U.S. were waiving fees, were giving things back, were trying to absorb all these costs so they could keep their funds at zero or as close to something slightly positive as possible. When you go into Europe, once they moved aggressively negative, then those funds said, okay, well, if we're already at negative 40 basis points, we'll start charging fees again because it's acceptable. So there are these frictions, these real frictions in the market where you don't have this seamless pass-through of these movements and rates.
And I want to step back for a minute. This goes to the fiscal question. So in a way, it seems to me just a frightening moment that we're talking about a world economy that is growing so slowly, with so little inflation, with such an excess of savings over investment, that we have to even seriously contemplate negative rates. Is this just another way of saying that we really have to find a way to get the political authorities to do better fiscal or, if you like, maybe better structural policies?
Well, there's a fundamental fact, which is that independent of what central banks do, that underlying forces are such that interest rates around the world are very low. I mean, I guess inflation is a policy choice, that's true, although at this point it's hard to imagine getting it really high. But real returns are very low for a lot of fundamental reasons, the saving investment imbalances and secular stagnation, all these various factors that people have discussed. So given that these interest rates are very low, then that creates this, makes this negative interest rate problem much more relevant. And there was a time when we, economists, thought that under most circumstances, the central bank could manage business cycle fluctuations with ordinary monetary policy. We're in a new world where, for reasons I think which may be related to some extent to the crisis, but we're probably in play for a long time, and we see a long-term downward trend in long-term interest rates. Given the low level of equilibrium interest rates, then we're just much closer to that particular constraint. So the advantage of very low interest rates is that fiscal policy becomes actually much less burdensome because governments can borrow at zero or even negative real interest rates and make socially constructive investments with that. Now, obviously, there are limits to that as well. But, you know, under these kinds of circumstances, we're talking hypothetically now about another slowdown, I think we really ought to be, the best thing maybe that central bank governors could do would be, you know, first thing would be talking to legislators and trying to persuade them of the importance of
policy. Given where we are now, I mean, whatever the mainstream forecast is, if the next president came in and said, I'd like to increase the deficit by, say, $50 billion or $100 billion and do these socially productive investments, even though I know it'll increase the deficit, would you say, thanks?
Well, deficits are not necessarily a great measure of fiscal responsibility, for example. So if the real rate of interest is zero, and particularly if there are unused resources in the economy, and you can make socially productive investments with that, that's not only a good deal from a business cycle point of view, it's a good deal from a long-run investment point of view.
Right.
So with low interest rates, we're not always in that situation. I don't want to say, you know, unreservedly that under all circumstances the government should be doing more infrastructure. We know that that's also a source of pork barrel projects and the like. But under those circumstances, it seems like it ought to be given consideration.
Arianna, how would you look at it?
Yeah, I think Ben hit a number of the key points. I think that there's two possible reasons why growth is low. One is purely it's low because our rate of innovation is slowed. This is the viewpoint that Robert Gordon especially has espoused. We don't know much about how to influence rates of innovation and productivity growth in the society. But on the other hand, I think it's also clear, at least to me, that given how low interest rates are, there would be gains to investing in infrastructure and investing in education. And those gains are enhanced by the fact that the interest rates being as low as they are. If governments were to do that, if governments around the world were to issue more pieces of paper that society is clamoring for, I think the prices on those pieces of paper would decline. And so that would be an upward pressure on interest rates beyond, and that would be especially helpful now given how low interest rates are.
Beth, so let's say that, help me see how the markets will look at this. If I go to negative interest rates, that doesn't immediately show up on the federal government's cash flow thing, although I suppose at some point it'll reduce the profits that the Fed gives to the Treasury. But if instead I said Congress passes a law that says we're going to subsidize every loan, that would increase the deficit. Do the markets distinguish between those two things? Do they strike them as totally different? Or do they understand them to be economically equivalent?
I think that the markets, when they look at the LSAP programs, I think there's a view that over time, those purchases should help funnel money back into the economy and give policymakers the confidence to go out and spend and put some money into these socially constructive programs. I think the fact that hasn't happened is, again, another one of the realities of kind of economic friction, that it's hard to get these policies through. I think markets generally want to see any amount of investment right now, because I think markets are at a place where they realize monetary policy has frankly been the hero over the last, you know, 6, 8, 10 years, and needs to be met with a more robust framework around it and can't just be acting alone in perpetuity.
You think markets wouldn't freak out if the reported deficit got a little bigger in the near term?
Not in the U.S. per se, because I think
in the U.S.
You look at it in other countries, in the U.S., you always have the ability to print more dollars, right? So no one is going to be worried about the creditworthiness of the U.S. because you can print more dollars and pay off that deficit.
As long as we raise the debt ceiling.
That's right. If you're looking at other places where they're borrowing not just in their home currency, then you could end up in some of those places.
Jamie, when you think about Japan, do you think, I think there's two possibilities. One is, wow, we should do everything possible so we never get in a situation like they're in, that we want to fix our banks sooner, we want to do more aggressive fiscal and monetary policy sooner so we never get there. Or the second thing is that all this stuff is diminishing marginal returns and we're really at the end of some really bad, the returns are substantially marginally diminished and we ought to be careful not to overuse these things. How do you look at the Japan experience?
I don't see it as diminishing marginal returns, and I you know, learned a lot from Ben's speech in Japan. Was it 2003?
For the ones he's kind of revised his views on that. It's not as easy as he thought
it was. It's not as easy. It's a terrific challenge that Japan is facing, and the that goes along with the demographic challenges they have. Their per capita income, though, has performed, you know, reasonably well over the last 20 years. But no, I think it shows the difficulty of getting policies designed correctly all the way along. Our colleagues Ken Kuttner and Adam Posen had a great paper on looking at the Japanese fiscal and monetary policies. This was about in 2005, looking over the previous 15 years. And it was a story of, push and pull, start and stop, both on the fiscal and monetary side and on the financial side as well in repairing their banks. So I think the policy coordination is very important and the policy sequencing is important to have the banks to be well capitalized going into a situation after suffering a crisis is very important. And then to have supportive fiscal and monetary policies is very important and sustained. But I don't think there is evidence of diminishing marginal returns to policy.
And I want to ask you one question before we turn to the audience. This morning, I don't think you were here, Torsten Slok made the point that when the central bank does a lot, it tends to take the pressure off the fiscal authorities. Kevin Warsh, former Fed governor, has made this point as well from a different perspective. When you are making monetary policy decisions, when you're thinking about QE or when you're weighing whether to cut interest rates, let alone push them negative, do you think about what the likely fiscal response is going to be and think if you do less, they might do a little more and you have a better mix, or is that just illegitimate?
Well, there are different political situations. I mean, the European Central Bank is in a somewhat different, more complex political environment than the Fed in the sense that it's answering to a number of different governments and it's played a more overt political role in trying to manage the Eurozone than the Fed, that is relevant to the Fed. I think in the Fed's case, the Fed has a mandate. The mandate doesn't say pursue these things only if you feel like it's game theoretically correct to do so. I mean, it says pursue those objectives. I think that's the Fed's goal. The Fed tries to take the fiscal policy as given. And I just don't think that either legally or in terms of political economy it makes sense for the Fed to be playing chicken with the Congress. I just don't think that's, first of all, it wouldn't work because Congress would do what it does anyway. I don't think it would. It would respond. What happen would be if the Fed didn't do its job, the economy would worsen. Whether the fiscal authorities would fully compensate for that is, I think, very dubious. So I'm not saying this is a illegitimate argument in all circumstances, but I think in the case of the United States, it's clearly legitimate. It's not the Fed's job to tell the Congress what to do. It's the Fed's job to do what Congress told it to do, which is to pursue its mandate. And certainly, it can use the bully pulpit. It can, the chair and other leaders of the Fed certainly can argue, that here's the reasons for such and such an approach. But I think to play chicken with the Congress would not be a wise strategy.
So let me start with, are there any of the panelists who want to weigh in now or not? All right, let's start. Roberto Perli over here.
Thank you. Roberto Perli, Cornerstone Macro. So it seems to me that there are a couple of issues with negative rates. One is that it's politically difficult, even leaving aside Miles' democratically dubious dirty approach. Also from an economic perspective, so the transmission between negative rates and markets works, seems to work more or less as expected. The transmission between markets and the economy that seems to be weaker, probably because it's hard to persuade people to do something with this low interest rate if they don't want to. So an alternative, Mr. Chairman, you brought up fiscal policy, certainly a lot better. There might be deficit issues, but so David, you brought up helicopter money. maybe your body language didn't suggest great enthusiasm for that idea.
For what?
Helicopter money.
That's not correct.
But isn't
I'm very enthusiastic.
But so great, thank you. But so both of the idea, both negative rates and helicopter money are difficult, politically difficult. But it seems to me, if we have to have this conversation with Congress, with Treasury, whoever, aren't we better off trying something that actually has a better chance of working, such as helicopter money? Mr. Chairman, you made a great case in your blog post, for example. This might be a good idea. What do you think?
Can I make a comment about the politics there for just a second?
Sure.
Which is just that presumably the politics is different when you're dealing with average person on Main Street versus, say, with big corporations, right? So beyond a certain point, if you had minus 400 basis points negative rates, that would be very pervasive in society. But minus 75 basis points, whatever, depending on how you structure it, the guy in the street, because you have term premia, because you have risk premia, liquidity premia, the guy taking out a mortgage is just going to see a lower mortgage rate, but a positive mortgage rate, probably not a negative mortgage rate. You know, so I think that we're only, remember, in practice, we're only talking about the rate of return on bank reserves held at the central bank. We're not talking about pervasive negative rates necessarily. So at least within some range, I think the politics is mostly fostered by self-interested people who don't like negative rates. But the average guy in the street doesn't see it. And wouldn't necessarily see it.
But I think Roberto's also saying negative rates are a hard sell. Helicopter money, that is the Fed agreeing to finance government spending or tax cuts, would be an easier sell.
Well, helicopter money is maybe one step beyond just ordinary fiscal policy in some sense. So it's not like the Fed can do helicopter money by itself. It needs the fiscal.
He was saying it might be easier to convince them. We're going to make it easy for you to cut taxes.
If that's so, I mean, that's a good question.
Does everybody agree? Roberto suggested that this doesn't get passed through to customers. So in Switzerland, it seems to be by policy it doesn't get passed through. But in Denmark, it did. And Massimo showed how by lowering rates below zero, other rates came down. It was not so different than a conventional easing. Wasn't that your point?
Well, I think that this is where the institutional structure makes such a difference, because in Denmark they have the mortgage-backed securities that have the balance principle, that what goes in one side has to come out the other side. So if it's being funded at these variable rate mortgages, funded at negative rates, then the borrower enjoys a negative rate. Whereas in Switzerland, it's a bank-based system. And so I think Narayana and I were talking outside. I think in the United States, we have a very hybrid system. But we do have, over 6,000 banks in the United States that make a lot of loans. Now, a lot of the mortgages, of course, are then sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they issue mortgage-backed securities. So it may well be that in the United States, mortgage rates would enjoy quite a bit of benefit from lower interest rate policy.
Gentleman right here. And then there's a gentleman on the, if you stand, raise your hand so the woman could find you with the mic.
My name is Peter Dugley from Swiss Broadcasting. My question goes to Mr. Bernanke. Of course, we have this experiment with negative rates since 1.5 years now. Would you say it's rather a failure or a success? And my second question, could you elaborate a little bit on under what circumstances would you think helicopter money would be a good tool? Thank you.
Well, I defer to my European colleagues on failure and success. I mean, I think it's one element of the European Central Bank and the Swiss National Bank's overall strategy. And I think that I'm supportive of the efforts of both the Swiss National Bank and the European Central Bank to achieve their inflation targets. And I think that, as far as I can tell, that negative rates have been a constructive part of that process. Because these policies are made up of so many different elements, and because there's so many things affecting the economy, it's hard to make a conclusive judgment at this point. But as far as I can tell, and I think the morning we had discussion of this, that they have affected rates and financial conditions, which presumably are part of the reason that some progress is being made. I had a blog post on helicopter money, and I think that it's something that certainly not within the likely feasible set in the United States, certainly. I mean, it's but it's important to discuss because, as we were saying earlier, it's important for people to understand that under extreme circumstances, there are tools that could be constructive, that could be used. It's not something that I think is, you know, is imminent.
The other guy, yes, thank you.
Hi, my name is Manmohan Singh from the IMF. The question is a choice between negative rates and, say, another $1 trillion of QE down the road, assuming the economy is still not moving. Do you think, given the balance sheet constraints we have, both in the private sector because of regulations, and now the official sector coming in and providing balance sheet space, for example, the reverse repo program with money market funds, et cetera, is a direct shortcut away from the plumbing straight to the Fed. You have reverse repo program with central banks. Now you have deposits of CCPs directly with the Fed. Can private or public balance sheets accommodate another $1 trillion of excess reserves down the road? Or perhaps a little bit negative rates will suffice, because I assume the regulations are not going to tweak the leverage ratio, et cetera, to provide more balance sheet space with the private banks.
Can I take a crack at that, Narayana?
Yeah, I think that these are fun questions to kick around, but I think it sets up a false dichotomy. There's a bunch of tools that are at the disposal of the Fed. I think there's certainly more room on the large-scale asset purchase front that could be done if desired. I think that there's more room to push interest rates lower if that's what's clearly now. But even as of December, there was more room to push interest rates lower. I think that if I going back to my own thinking over the last few years as a FOMC participant, I think too often I frame choices for myself in terms of either or, as opposed to let's use both these tools because we're going to work in a complementary fashion to achieve our objectives. And I think the way you framed it just now, my response to that would be, no, let's if it's needed to get to where we want to go, let's do both things.
Gentleman there, yes, stand up so they can find you.
Thank you. My name is Fuji from Happy Science Group based in Tokyo. My question is, Mr. Bernanke, half a year ago, BOJ, Bank of Japan, adopted negative interest rate policy. However, it seems that this policy doesn't have much impact on Japanese economy at present. If you were an advisor to BOJ, what kind of policy would you recommend to Japanese economy?
Well, what I'm going to say is that I think that there's been one move to negative rates, one 10 basis point move, and there were some issues about communication that Narayana pointed to. I think it's way too early to judge what effect that's going to have. And I'm basically very supportive of the Bank of Japan and its strong efforts to end deflation. And while it certainly hasn't achieved its objective yet, it's also made progress. And so, I'm supportive of their efforts to end deflation.
Narayana, what lesson should we draw from the Japanese experience?
I think that the overall experience, if you go back over the last 3 years, has been very positive relative to my own expectations going in. I think that they've been able to push inflation up higher than I might have anticipated. It's, I think this particular episode in January, the communication could have been better around the rolling out of negative interest rates. But I have to say, you cut interest rates by 10 basis points in the central banking world, you actually don't expect a huge response from that. There's a bunch of other shocks that are hitting the system at the same time that are likely to swamp anything that's going on. And I think that's what we heard described earlier this morning from the empirical work, is you actually saw the quote-unquote policy change having an effect within the typical window, but then it's just getting overwhelmed by a bunch of other considerations.
Beth, how well do you think central banks in general and the Fed in specific do in communicating right now? How would you grade them on how well they communicate?
As opposed to in the past.
Well, that's a really
good question. That was a carefully calibrated question.
I think it is a unique challenge right now as a central banker.
Well, are you auditioning for the Board of Governors? That's like...
God, no. I think it's a unique challenge right now because I think markets are very impatient. I think right now they're probably more impatient than they have ever been. And so let's go back and look at the case of Japan. So the policy was announced in January. It was effective in February. But because it was such a surprise, markets weren't prepared for it. You didn't actually see negative rate trading until April. And then it starts to actually permeate through. But already, we're barely in June. People are saying, how come it's not working? How come it's not working, right? These things take time as you move through it. I think the challenge that I see for the Federal Reserve in New York, in the U.S. right now, is that it's moving between this fine line between wanting to put out a picture of optimism on the economy, but not wanting to see these overreactions where you get financial conditions tightening when they talk positively about the economy. So you see kind of this vicious loop going back and forth where they say things look good, we might be able to tighten, we might look at not normalizing policy, taking some steps along that path. And then the market goes, okay, 20 basis points. Let's raise 20 basis points. And you have, the stock market doesn't like it. So you get these really pro-cyclical effects from the financial conditions that ends up meaning you end up in a place where the Fed can't actually move if they wanted to move. And so I think there is a real challenge between this openness, which has, I think, been very good in terms of market participants trying to better understand what the reaction function of central bankers is going to be, but also kind of front-running to some extent those movements such that you can't actually see those impacts happen.
Trying to get my head around the Fed being, the markets being more impatient than ever. That's kind of, let me give Miles a shot here and then we'll go to some of the others.
So I think the discussion of helicopter money is interesting. Now, I don't want to sound too positive about helicopter money, which I think is a mistake, but I think that what Ben was saying there is important. I think we ought to be talking about deep negative interest rates in the same way we're talking about helicopter money, and because we should be saying things like, look, there is no lower bound. It's a matter of which policy choices you make. Obviously, the deeper interest rates you go, the bigger deal that is. But we can go as low as we need to get the economy back. And I think that helps get you confidence. Also, we saw Massimo's very interesting presentation that if you can convince the markets that the lower bound is lower, every 25 basis points you convince the market that the lower bound is lower, you get more room in what's happening in the long-term interest rates. So I think whatever you think about doing it in for real, I think we should be talking about in the tail events being able to go as low as we need to with negative interest rates. I think that's a very good thing for the world to hear.
Okay. I want to give people have an ask. So there's a gentleman there behind Peter.
Hi, my name is Stefan Sabo from the New York Fed. I'm just wondering how you interpret, in terms of market reactions to the move towards negative at the ECB and maybe even in Japan. You've had sovereign bond yield curves flatten. Is that why, and what does that really say about how the market is interpreting additional easing?
What is flattened?
He said the sovereign yield curves have flattened. Is that right, Massimo? Have sovereign yield curves flattened since you went to negative rates? Can you give the mic to, let me,
Here you go. I showed this curve, no? The swap-derived quasi-risk-free curve. And I think if you compare current curve to the pre-negative rate policy curve, one is, of course, a lot lower, but it has been more or less a parallel shift. It's not obviously a flattening.
I would just say to the extent that we have seen any flattening in global bond markets, I would attribute that more to the bond buying programs than to the negative rates. It's hard to tease out which is coming from which, but I think the buying of the long parts of the market is more what's driven down that flattening than the negative rates.
Right. That's a good point. I mean, it's very difficult to tease out the effect of negative rates when so many other things are going on at the same time. I'm going to take like three or four questions and we'll give an answer. So there's a gentleman there, and then there's one way in the back. Brandon, can you go give the mic way in the back?
Hi, my name's Alex Kokonakis with the FDIC. You mentioned that banks have some sort of exemptions from negative rates, but I'm kind of worried about money market funds and what kind of impact they're having from the low interest rate environment. Maybe they don't, they're not in the same position as banks are. And you mentioned there's a reach for yield behavior probably going on with the low interest rates. So are we seeing a reduction in activity with money market funds? And if so, can they pass on negative rates to their investors as well or not?
Okay, money market fund, gentleman in the back.
Yeah, Kareem Basta from III Capital. I was just wondering about demographics. We know different age groups think differently about low rates, where the elderly who rely more on interest income are generally more opposed versus younger people who borrow. And I wonder if that is sort of magnified several times over with negative rates. And again, you look at Japan with a rapidly aging population where the stock market value has been cut in half over the last 20, 30 years. The currency's appreciated, and now, you know, people are saying, now you're going to tax my savings. That's really not acceptable. So are the challenges towards implementing negative rates greater given some of these demographic issues?
Okay, I think you had a question? And then my friend from T. Rowe Price, whose name I can't remember.
Hi, I'm Doug Carr with Carr Capital. I wonder if you think we could have reached a point where the traditional stimulative effect of reduced interest rates no longer applies. If you think about reduced cost of capital for one investor, that means a reduced return on capital for whomever is financing that. We've raised asset prices. That suggests a lower future return on capital. We've got a very low riskless interest rate, again, suggesting a low future return on capital. With all these factors that could influence a low future return on capital, that suggests there could be lower investment, which in fact, in the US and Japan, with the longer experience we have with these ultra low rates, we've got investment relative to GDP at or near historical levels. So could we possibly be in a zone where the interest rate stimulus doesn't work any longer?
So you think if we raise interest rates, we get more investment?
Depends how you do it. It's complicated.
And over here on the aisle?
Chris Vogt, McDonough with T. Rowe Price. So one of the questions, you know, as you've been battling around negative interest rate policy, one of the things that is crucial, though, in getting it to work is whether people actually choose to borrow. Maybe it's the flip side of questions that just was asked, and that is, what would be your best metric that even if you embarked on lower rates, that people would be willing to actually borrow the money in order to embark on those projects? I just don't take as a signpost to this what's happened with oil prices, right? Oil prices have moved lower. People have saved, not spent, more than what the traditional rules of thumb would have suggested. So this suggests households in the U.S. at least are still in balance sheet repair mode. That would impede negative interest rate policy. So just what kind of considerations you look at, and what are the signals you would, or what kind of changes would you like to see in order to see that the balance sheets are in position for taking on additional leverage?
Okay, Jamie, let me start with you. Do you want to take the money market fund question? To what extent are they a constraint on negative rates, and should we worry about money market funds anyways?
Yeah, and embedded in that question was also this notion that banks are exempt from the policy. It's important to understand how the policy works in Japan and Switzerland, for example. So banks' inframarginal holdings of reserves, all but the last portion of reserves, get paid zero, and then just the marginal part of reserves get paid a negative rate. That, just because the inframarginal reserves are paid zero, that doesn't mean they have to pay their depositors zero. So, you know, there's really no relationship between what they charge their depositors. That's a separate decision. So the banks are charging depositors zero out of their own, you know, calculations of profit and loss. So I think that's an interesting behavior that we are seeing in these negative interest rate economies, and should make us think about why are they not charging their depositors less than zero. With the money market mutual funds, there have been a lot of revisions to the policies for money market mutual funds. Ben Bernanke pointed out in his recent blog, so that the prime funds are variable net asset funds now. They're no longer fixed assets, so they could potentially pay below, a buck for when one redeems one share. That reduces the concern for money market mutual funds, but still many of the government-only funds will be fixed net asset value funds, and so there still is the problem of breaking a buck on the money market mutual funds.
Arianna, two of the questions basically said, is there anything that monetary policy can do to get people to borrow that it hasn't already done? Do you think we've reached the point where people won't borrow?
No, I think on the margin, rates are lower, that induces people to borrow more. There's questions about is it as effective to go from, zero to minus 25 basis points as it is from 3 to 2.75%, 3% to 3.75%. I think you can start to quibble about that. But on the margin, having lower interest rates encourages people to borrow. But it's not just about encouraging borrowing. It's about encouraging spending now as opposed to saving. In fact, I often get emails from people who are saying, you're forcing me to spend because the rate of return is so low. Yeah. That's the policy. That is what the policy is about. It's being effective when you're forced to spend as opposed to save. Let me make one final comment about the investment question. I think this question is a great one because it just indicates the terrible challenge that we've introduced as economists by using words in multiple ways. So you use the word investment in two different ways in your question. One is in terms of physical investment, building factories, and then the other way is financial investment, which is buying pieces of paper that are paying a rate of return. The whole point of the policy is to make buying pieces of paper seem really, really bad, and that makes factories, which we're not really affecting the return to that at all through monetary policy, seem an attractive thing. The fact that there's not more investment going on is because Miles has not been successful in getting his negative rates of return spreading through the financial system.
Ben,
I agree with that. And we don't know empirically, in textbook terms, how flat the IS curve is, so how quick, right, how much response there is at given levels of interest rates. But there's actually pretty good reason to think that if rates get negative enough, then almost anything will be
well,
a good return.
Yeah.
So, but yes, that's right. So the monetary policy doesn't affect the rate of return on physical investments in terms of how productive they would be in producing widgets or how many people could be housed or whatever. What they affect is the cost of funding those investments. So as that cost of funding goes down, then there might be more opportunities for real capital investments. There's another similar logical error, which says, oh, people aren't investing in capital things, they're buying back shares instead. Those things are not alternatives.
Yeah.
These are just alternative ways of structuring your balance sheet. But buying back shares or paying dividends does not mean that you still wouldn't want to make profitable capital investments. So those things are not alternatives. They could be actually complementary in certain circumstances. One more comment on the bigger picture, though. I mean, it is still possible that within the range of feasible interest rates that monetary policy is not powerful enough to achieve your objectives within a reasonable time frame, which, again, is the reason why fiscal policy sometimes would be appropriate.
So why do you think businesses seem to be so reluctant to invest, given how easy credit terms are?
Yeah. There's two good reasons. One is the productivity gains are very low for whatever reason. Now, part of that is a result as opposed to a cause. But to the extent that, whatever reason, technological opportunities are more restricted, that reduces the return to investment. That's one possibility. The other possibility is I think that the effective lower bound, Miles's effective lower bound, is even in the U.S. where we've moved a little bit away from it, we're still trading with the rest of the world where in many places it is still effective. You know, I think that has, to some extent, made aggregate demand weaker than it otherwise would be. And clearly, everything we know about capital investment says that at least as important as cost of capital is demand. So if demand is inadequate, firms are not going to invest very much, even if the cost of capital is low.
And Arianna, finally, there was one question about demographics. Is that,
I mean, that's always an issue in monetary policy, right? There are savers and borrowers, and lower interest rates favor one over the other.
Yeah, I think that those kind of disputes are always out there. They've certainly become more pointed and more heated, I think, as interest rates remain as low as they have for as long as they have. In some public finance economists are fond of using this term salient, which basically refers to what kinds of information is really a particularly apparent to a decision maker. It sometimes seems to me when I'm getting questions and comments from the public that low interest rates are much more salient to savers than than they are to borrowers. And so I seem to hear a lot from how unusually low savers are. But I think that it is true that that the changing demographics across the world are going to be pushing for both higher interest rates and low inflation. So I think that's just something that's going to be played out all over the world.
Jean-Pierre.
Yes, I maybe come back to my question of democratic legitimacy. I think if you want to be serious about negative rate, and I think clearly you want to be, at least as one potential option, we've got to be able to go lower than the minus 75 basis point. And we know we have a solution, which is a smart solution, that's Miles. I think it's implementable. But it has to be sold to the public and to the political. And I would like to know what your prospect and what methods you envisage to get there in order to get really that ammunition if it is to be needed in the future.
Talking to me? So I actually think the first step in all this is, I'm an intellectual by bent, and I think the first step is to sell it intellectually, that this is something that's important. I think the reaction of many economists might be to say, zero minus five, it doesn't matter. Monetary policy cannot do much to help speed a recovery from a deep recession. You have to solve that problem first. If you get a large enough intellectual push from the profession as a whole, or some wide swath of it, I think starts to make the dialogue easier. And then you have to reach out to congressmen and elected officials who will be responsive to that kind of intellectual discourse. To go down the route that Miles described, I do not think it's something that's going to happen in 5 years. I don't see it as happening. And I think it would be a huge mistake, and this is what you were getting at, to wake up one morning and say, let's go down to minus 200 basis points. And then go testify to Congress the next Humphrey Hawkins and tell them what we did. That's the point you're making. I agree with that completely.
You want to add to that, Penn?
I don't have much to add except, I think it is important to get your academic ducks in a row. It's important for have conferences and to think about and try to make sure people understand the issues. Then you want to do the best you can to explain it publicly. I would guess, as Don suggested, that something like this would probably be unlikely unless the circumstances were sufficiently adverse that people were in a more experimental mood like FDR was, obviously, in the 1930s. But I don't know. I mean, there's no harm in trying to explain these ideas. And perhaps if we do end up in those circumstances, which I hope we don't, at least some groundwork would have been laid. So I commend these discussions. I think it's useful to talk about them, particularly making the point that someone made earlier that if you wait until the crisis to start airing these ideas, that's probably the wrong time to start being bringing in such different approaches.
Okay, with that, I'm going to call this conference to close. It's been a long day, and I appreciate all of you. Please join me in thanking the speaker. If I can ask you to look at your feet and do a negative draw of the paper and put it in the positive flow of the garbage can, I appreciate it.